Welcome to the 109th episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 76 years to the day that Ali Mouddin became the youngest person ever to play in a first-class game, aged just 12 years and 73 days. Welcome to the podcast that had just about worked on how to put on a pair of pads by that age.
Yes, we can never be accused of squandering our youthful talent because we, well, just never had any. In this episode, we are going to be talking about, as we always do, about some of the things that have caught our attention over the last couple of weeks. Andy went to a fascinating event and made me green with envy, and he's going to be telling us about that. I'm going to be talking about the history of the coin toss, which actually is something that I realised as I researched I didn't know an awful lot about. And we've also been reading All Wickets Great and Small in Search of Yorkshire's Grassroots Cricket by John Fuller. If you enjoy the podcast, please do tell a friend. Please do hop over onto iTunes and leave us a review there. But before you do it, you probably want to hear what we've got to say in this, the 109th episode of Reverse Swept Radio. Now, Andy, last week you were in the presence of some kind of cricketing greats, I suppose, of different kinds.
Yes, so I went to see Mike Brearley speak at Daunt's Bookshop in London, and he was in conversation with the journalist and cricket lover and cricket author, actually, Peter Oborne. They made a rather wonderful combination. So Mike Brearley, very gently spoken, very polite, kind of like a sort of older professor kind of figure. Peter Oborne is a boomer. You know, his voice kind of echoes probably several kind of counties away every time he speaks. They were actually a rather wonderful pair.
And is it fair to say that Mike Brearley is kind of, he's always struck me as being quite considered and fair and softly spoken, all of those things that seem to come across in his captaincy, whereas Peter Oborne seems to be someone who wears his opinions quite strongly. You know, he's a man who certainly knows what he thinks and wouldn't be afraid to put that across. That's always a preconception I have. Is that fair?
It's very much how it worked. Peter Oborne would come crashing in with a big question, and to be fair, really good questions. And Mike Brearley would then sort of very cautiously and carefully kind of pull it apart. I think Brearley's politeness is certainly something that comes across. He treated every audience member's question, including mine, with sort of incredible respect. It was a personal life highlight for me when he described my question as extremely interesting and one he hadn't been asked before.
Straight to the top of the CV.
Exactly. So I asked him which era he would have chosen to captain in, if not his own. And he gave an excellent answer where he said he wouldn't have wanted to captain today because he said the problem now is there were so many additional coaches that he says he enjoyed being a captain in an era when he really ran the show. And he said actually he would have struggled to captain in an era much earlier than his because he said quite understandably actually the whole professional amateur distinction in the dressing room would have sat very uneasily with him. So a very good answer if one that slightly dodged the question. Where he brings, I think, sort of wonderful value is in the fact that he is this sort of trained psychologist and went on to have this career after cricket in that. And he was asked by one member, you know, given you're a psychologist, given you are also someone who played cricket at the highest level, what would you say about the mindset of facing 90-mile-an-hour bowling? And he quoted Samuel Johnson saying, hanging focuses the mind wonderfully, and went on to speak, I think, sort of very well about those kind of challenges. I think the whole evening kind of left me in no doubt that sort of Brearley's reputation as a thinker about the game remains kind of very much well earned. I think there's probably aspects about the modern game where I think understandably, I mean, he's in his mid-70s now where his fingers maybe not quite on the pulse as it was. He's certainly not from the kind of fuddy-duddy school of thought. You know, he's not anti-2020. And interestingly, he was quite up for defending Joe Root. So Peter Oborne kind of raised this issue of, you know, you get these England captains now who've had no experience at the county game. And interestingly, Brearley very much came to defence of Root's captaincy. So, yes, a very engaging evening.
What did you learn about? Because one thing that, you know, we both think about a bit, given that we, you know, host a podcast on cricket, is how you engagingly talk about something like cricket. Which, when you see it done badly, you know, talking about cricket can be a really dull thing. But what did you learn about that? How you bring the game, you know, to life for an audience? What was the who was the audience there? Was it kind of complete cricket nuts, and was it very detailed and technical in terms of the discussion, or was it quite philosophical? You talk about drawing on things like Samuel Johnson. Was it much more discursive and philosophical in that way?
So the audience was, I think, kind of predictable in the sense that it was predominantly sort of older and male and sort of quite kind of on the sort of cricket fanatic end of the spectrum. There were, gratifyingly, actually, there were a few sort of younger people and actually a few kids who'd been brought as well, which I think it was great to see. I think in terms of talking engagingly about it, I think the two hats perspective that he has of his experience in the game, but also this kind of someone who has then approached the sort of psychological roots of it, I think work very, very well. The other thing is really all about quality of questions. And I think this is one of the things where an event like this sort of succeeds or fails. So we had questions from Peter Oborne and then open to the floor. And the questions from the floor were mixed. I think, you know, one person at one stage asked, why were you such a good captain? Which is sort of, you know...
It's not getting straight to the heart of the matter.
No, it's not. And Mike Brearley was, as he was for every question, incredibly polite and incredibly courteous. But really, if you want to get into these things, you need to ask slightly better questions than that. I think also it's probably this combination between big ideas and anecdotes. And I guess this comes into a lot of good cricket writing as well. So Brearley, given his experience in the game, had an unbelievable collection of sort of anecdotes from his personal experience, players he'd met, and using them to illustrate examples, I think, worked really, really well. And I think the other side of it, I think, is plenty of examples, and I guess it's something we try to do on the podcast, is where an idea that to some extent is a cricket idea actually has ramifications for life more generally. One thing I came away thinking was Brearley had talked with a lot of interest about Zafar Ansari, who, of course, retired from the game last year, and so a figure we've talked a bit about. And, you know, Brearley is really interested in that idea of, you know, cricketers with a sort of hinterland beyond cricket. And actually, it really made me come away with the idea thinking that the event someone should do is have Brearley in conversation with Zafar Ansari. I think that'd be a really fascinating evening.
Well, there we go. Maybe that's what we should do for the next iteration of Reverse Flip Radio, live events hosted by Mike Brearley. Make it happen, Andy.
Well, he owes me a favour because, you know, I did buy his book.
you did ask him. Question of his career, so
I did exactly. Now, while I've been just sitting there drinking and listening, you've been playing and playing with some success.
Yeah, so it's sort of coming towards the end of the Australian summer now, and I actually play cricket all year round here. I play for a summer team and for a winter team because the winter never quite comes in Sydney. And the team I play for through the summer is my work team. So I work for the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. And in order to really strike fear into the hearts of our opponents, we actually often tell people that the ABC in our team name obviously stands for Australia's Best Cricketers, which strikes fear but then is often laughed down when they see us even attempting to warm up, because I have to say a more ragtag group of cricketers you will never see on a wicket. It's not so much the case that we usually struggle to get a full team out, or that most people turn up having had a heavy night the night before and barely able to walk. It's more the fact that, you know, in our attitude towards the game, we're not like a lot of Australian friendly, in inverted commas, cricket is dominated by people who just have to win, and they will do anything they can to win, and they will sledge umpires and they will sledge anyone else, and they'll be in a really bad mood if they don't win. With us, I think we're fundamentally too nice, and so it's that situation where we don't have any kind of ruthlessness that allows us to close out a game, and we're always a bit embarrassed when we win, and we're always pretty happy just not to lose horrendously. You know, losing gently is sort of the place in which we're comfortable. It's quite an English attitude in many ways. So imagine this: as I write, or as we speak, we've actually won 6 games in a row, and I can't tell you how monumental this is. Our record before that was winning 2 games in a row, and I don't think 2 games in a row can necessarily count as a winning streak. So suddenly our entire attitude towards the game has changed. We're We're sitting top of the league. We're in the league semi-final in a couple of weeks' time. And suddenly there's this amazing feeling where when we go out and play, everyone cares about every single ball. You know, if you're bowling, you feel a real weight of responsibility. If you go out to open the batting, I was batting last weekend and I had a bit of a shocking innings, and I felt like I just sort of couldn't live it down somehow. And suddenly all of our perspectives on the game has just totally changed, and now we sort of have this strange pride in what we do. So look, I'll report back on how we go in those finals, but it's been quite an astonishing change to actually play for a cricket team that wins. And I think it's the first time in what I'm going to call my cricketing career that I've actually ever done that.
Is there something you can point to? Was there a kind of team meeting where you said, right, this has got to be different? Has there been a captain taking a new approach? Or has this been serendipity? You know, you got a good run going and one thing has led to another.
It's interesting you should call out those things, because the only team meetings we ever have is going to the pub after the game, when we don't really talk about cricket at all, or at least don't talk about our own cricket at all. Change of captain, the captaincy kind of swaps hands quite a lot, and I've captained a couple of games, so I can vouch for the fact that it's not the captain. It's really difficult to define what it is. I think it was suddenly that sense of, once we won a couple of games, almost by accident, we sort of thought to ourselves, actually, winning is quite fun. And we then had a moment where, actually, so we play in a 2020 league where one of our batsmen scored 133 off 24 balls, which is a pretty astonishing innings in and of its own right, really. When you think about the maths of that, that's quite extraordinary. But it was that sort of sense of, we got used to winning, and suddenly that became the thing that was the default. So almost by stealth, it certainly wasn't by intention, because there's not a lot that this cricket team can do by intention and actually pull it off.
The thing I'm very taken with in your description and can really relate to is this thing of like the approach, taking it seriously, caring about every ball. Because I think I have been quite relaxed and can have a wonderful time with a team that loses a fair amount of the time. I've always found it difficult to be a member of a team that just doesn't care. If you know, I think it's very difficult being a team that just slightly, you know, is not bothered in the field, treats the whole thing as a bit of a joke. I think, you know, the funny thing about sport, as we touch on often in this podcast, is it both matters a huge amount and doesn't matter at all. And once you almost drop that facade, and once you almost say like, oh, who cares, who matters, the whole thing sort of... So I think your point about the moment you start taking it seriously and approaching it, that radically changes how everyone feels about it. From the archives, and this episode, Toby is going to be taking a close look at the history of that rather peculiar ritual that begins cricket games all over the world of all formats, the coin toss.
So it is the one constant through every single game of cricket, I suppose, other than kind of grass and bats and balls, but bear with me here. It is the thing that starts off every single cricket game, and I suddenly realised when I was watching a coin toss the other day that I actually knew very little about it, where it had come from and why it existed. So that's what I thought that I'd delve a little bit into, and in delving into it I realised that there's enough material on the history of the coin toss to fill thousands of From the Archive features on Reverse Threat Radio, so we may well have to revisit this one at some point. So on its simplest level, the toss is what decides who bats and who bowls first. The other important thing to note is that it actually indicates the official start of the game. So when the coin toss happens, that is actually when the game officially starts. And that's important because it means that if play is abandoned before the toss has happened, then the game never exists in statistical records. But if the game is abandoned after the toss has happened, then it does officially count as a game within the statistical record of cricket. It's also the moment, the toss, that in professional cricket, as it were, it's the game at which the team selections are made concrete. So it's at the toss, at the meeting of the two captains during the toss, that the player sheets are exchanged, and after that point, the captains cannot make changes to their side. So in that way, the coin toss is an important moment, sort of symbolically, at the start of the game to kick things off.
And I guess one of the issues about the idea of this, the game being official, is this has statistical connotations as well. I mean, I know a lot of records are built around the idea of numbers of innings, for example. But I suppose, would it then be right to say that if you're trying to be the quickest batsman to a certain target within a certain number of games, a game abandoned after the coin toss would count against your record then?
It would, yeah, it would count as a... I mean, it would. You obviously would only have an innings at the same point, at the point that your innings actually starts, but yeah, the game has officially started at that point, so there then has to be a game abandoned, a draw, tie, win or lose at that point. So yes, the game officially exists at that point and is marked against a game that the team has played, whichever one of those results, including abandoned, then comes into force. And it's also you would have a cap as a player. You would have your first test cap if the toss happened and the game was abandoned, but you wouldn't have that cap if the game was abandoned a second before the toss happen. That is one of the fundamental differences as well. So coin tosses have been around since the very beginning of the game of cricket. So the first codified set of cricket laws, which happened in 1744, includes mention of the toss. And what's interesting here is that it's both about who bats first, but also the side winning the toss gets to choose which pitch they play on. This was changed a few years later so that actually the visiting team, the team playing away from home, had the ability to choose on both fronts. So a few years later, another iteration of the laws was published, and in that the toss was done away with, and there was simply the case that the visiting captain got to choose who batted first and which pitch they were going to play on. Now that was then overturned again a few years later in 1809, where we actually got to the situation that we have today, which is that the umpires choose which pitch is played on, and there is a toss to decide who bats and who fields. And what's particularly interesting is that this course of history, the way in which the toss has been used to decide that certain things, has actually repeated itself quite interestingly in recent times. So in 2018, just last year, many people will remember that the ICC actually tried to do away with the coin toss. So there was a lot of concern that home advantage was having too big an effect on a lot of games. And so the idea was that if you got rid of the coin toss, you then said to the visiting captain, you can decide whether to bat or bowl first, and that actually did a bit to counteract home advantage, and particularly the home advantage that comes in preparing your own pitch. So that actually it was the visiting captain who could decide whether they, you know, put the opposition in on a sticky wicket or not. In county cricket, and again, this is the thing that I'd never realised. I'd be interested, Andy, if you knew this. But in the county championship, there's actually a rule that the away captain can choose to bowl first without the toss happening. So you can turn up, you can decide to bowl first. If you don't want to bowl first, then the toss has to happen. So if you want to bat first, then there has to be a toss, and then whoever wins it can decide. But if you're an away captain, if you want to bowl first, then you can decide to do that without the toss happening. And the reason for that is, again, a bit like the ICC situation, the ECB had identified that too many green pitches, which are really great for medium pace but weren't developing spinners, were being prepared by home sides. And so what this rule meant was that if you prepared a really green pitch, you had to be willing to bat first up on it. So you had to know that an away captain could come in, put you straight in on that wicket. Green pitches are much harder to bat on. So actually, it disincentivized home sides from preparing really, really green pitches. Were you aware of that in terms of the county championship? Was that just a blind spot in my own knowledge?
Yeah, no, I was aware of it. I think hearing you sort of set it out there, I think it really got me thinking about the fact that I don't know to what extent there's been sort of thorough analysis on how much this has improved the situation or not. I mean, I think, as you said, what's absolutely fascinating is you're going back to a situation of the sort of early 19th, end of the 18th century, where you're trying to solve a very specific problem, aren't you? This sort of home advantage issue of creating pitches to see. It's funny how that issue is kind of a real constant in the game. It's an issue that we were grappling with then, grappling with now.
Yeah, absolutely.
How you sort of take that advantage, or at least, I guess it's not a question of eradicating that advantage, but of not making it so dominant that it destroys the contest.
Yeah. So interestingly, just to close off on that narrative, and we'll come back to some of the stats actually, because the stats are really instructive when it comes to coin tosses. When it comes to the idea that the ICC mooted last year about scrapping the toss, there was a lot of debate that came out of that, and in the end it was decided that the toss would not be scrapped, so we would continue with having the toss at the beginning of every game. And interestingly, the reasons that the ICC cited for doing that was not because they said, we've done the statistical analysis and we realise it's not necessarily going to help. The actual reasons were more to do with the kind of culture and history of the game. So they described the toss as an integral part of the sport, which, quote, forms part of the narrative of the game. So essentially, you know, they were saying, look, this is actually just part and parcel of the game for so many people. It's an iconic part of the game. Why would we get rid of it at this point? And it was an interesting moment, actually, when the kind of culture of cricket and the history and tradition of cricket trumped the sort of statistical analysis and the practicality of the game there. So it is an interesting question of actually how important the toss is. And now this is where we could spend days and days poring over this kind of data. But as a brief overview, in test matches since 2000, 41% of games are won by the team that wins the toss, and 36% of games are won by those who lose it. So there's a 5% margin in who wins the toss and who doesn't. In a way, that's not surprising, because we all know the instances where captains have made horrendous calls and ended up batting first on a wicket that really would take a day to settle down, or ended up, you know, batting second and batting last on a wicket that was really, really turning against spinners. So there are some kind of howlers there.
Which leads to one of the cricketing phrases that for a long time, particularly as a young cricket fan, I just could not comprehend, when a journalist or commentator would say, a good toss to lose, which I always used to, this used to blow my mind as a phrase. And of course, it's exactly the situation you're describing then, when it's the kind of pitch where you're like, oh God, I think we should bat first, because, you know, batting first is always the done thing if you're not sure. And then actually you end up putting yourself in on some horrendous track.
Exactly.
So yes,
exactly.
There do seem to be these situations where winning gives the captain a dilemma they'd rather their opposite number had.
Totally. The interesting thing, though, is that when you look at that 41% of games won by the team that wins the toss and 36% by those who lose it, and thank you, by the way, to the statistician who pulled that together, I'm glad I didn't have to, that means that across 15 test results, the winner of the toss wins 8, and the loser of the toss wins seven. And so, actually, how much of a big difference is that? In the sense that within the margin of error in cricket, particularly in this day and age where there are fewer and fewer draws in the game, and cricket is played at a much faster pace for a whole lot of reasons, actually the fact that it's only a margin of one game out of 15, actually, is that a significant enough margin actually to change the entire laws? And that was some of the thinking, I think, that went into the ICC not wanting to change the law around cricket tosses. There are some brilliant sort of statistical nuggets that happen around tosses. So there is now a rule in the universe that if Virat Kohli wins a toss in a test match, India do not lose. So he has won the toss 21 times as captain of India, the Indian test team. And of those, they've won 18 and they've drawn 3. Now, what this stat actually points to is something which is really significant, which is that often the arbitrary toss of the coin is used as an excuse or a reason for teams winning or losing, when actually the reason that a team has won or lost is simply because that team is good or bad. So whilst it would be tempting to draw from this that Kohli has some kind of magic toss, magic touch for the coin toss. Actually, what this points to is the fact that India are a really solid side at the moment, and therefore, when they actually, you know, get those marginal decisions around batting first or bowling first, that they're very likely to win. That's really all that you can draw out of that. What is quite interesting, on the other hand, is when you look at captains who have the regardless of whether the team goes on to win or lose, who just do not have the ability to win the toss. So Nasser Hussain holds the record for the longest losing streak with coin tosses. He actually lost 10 consecutive tests in a row. I don't know what the statistical probability of that is, but I reckon that it's probably quite small.
Well, at the end of last year, I think I'm right in saying Joe Root won 8 consecutively. I think he won every toss in the home series against India, and then I think every one in the away series against Sri Lanka. And I remember at the time there were some wonderful statistics going on about how improbable that was. So yes, that is interesting. Actually, I wonder if particularly when things are just not going your way on the pitch. And then you lose every toss, you sort of start to, I guess, fear that the world has it in for you more generally. Yeah, Nasser Hussain has always had that aura, hasn't he, of being a man who felt it was sort of him against the universe.
And probably captaining the England side at that time, it really was him against the universe. But I think it's an interesting point. So this going back to this argument about how you make matches away from home more equitable, there is a big argument that Adam Gilchrist came out with quite vocally a couple of years ago, where he just said, hang on, look, we know that teams perform better at home. They're used to the conditions. They've got their home sides. They're not on the road for 3 months of a year. Can't we just accept that there are going to be more victories from teams at home than there are teams playing away from home? And why are we blaming the toss for this? And in many ways, because the toss is such an iconic part of the game of cricket, we do come to think that, you know, we do come to invest so much in it and to say that it's so much. It's responsible for so much across the rest of the game. There is, of course, the whole question about whether you should bat or bowl. I think that's going to be if you win the toss, that's going to be a subject for another podcast. But I think it's probably apt to just end with the words of W.G. Grace, which are the ones that I always think of whenever I'm having to conduct a toss for the team, which is simply, when you win the toss, bat. If you're in doubt, think again and bat. If you have very big doubts, consult a colleague and then bat. The review, and for this episode we have been reading All Wickets Great and Small, In Search of Yorkshire's Grassroots Cricket by John Fuller.
So John Fuller takes us on quite a tour. You need to get your map out and have a look here, because we go from Scarborough to Wakefield to Woolton to Harrogate to Paddock to Bradford to Renthorpe to Skipton. It really is. And we go everywhere on the bus. We go everywhere on the bus, and as we learned quickly, John Fuller is passionate about cricket, and also is always happy to give his tuppence worth on public transport as well. The idea is that this is an attempt to, in a way, I guess, we've covered some similar books, something like Harry Pearson's Slipless and Settle, or at a slightly different level, Duncan Hamilton's Last English Summer, that look to kind of capture the game at a particular point. And this is an attempt to capture the recreational game, or sort of the club game in Yorkshire at a particular point. And so each chapter is dedicated to a club. And we get the sort of local town, local area. We get a bit about the club, a bit about the game, and sometimes some of the personalities involved. Now, the book subtitle is In Search of Yorkshire's Grassroots Cricket. What do we find, Toby, when we go in search of Yorkshire's grassroots cricket?
Well, what I think is quite impressive about this book is the kind of coverage. So there are 23 clubs, some of which you so deftly mentioned at the top of the review. 23 clubs that are visited over the course of a single summer, actually. And so what you do get a sense is the kind of variety. You get a sense of the things that make these clubs tick. the people behind the scenes that go into, you know, making everything from the club tees to the to everything, you know, to everything else along the way. You also get the sense of the some of the history of this, the fabric of cricket, in which is so rich in somewhere like Yorkshire in terms of the length of history in some cases, in other cases the way that clubs have had to adapt, and that can be through clubs starting, through clubs shutting down, and through clubs merging in some circumstances as well. So in that sense, I think it gives quite an interesting just sort of overview of Yorkshire grassroots cricket. I think that in some ways this book does itself a disservice by trying to do too many things, in the sense that it's also, as well as talking about Yorkshire cricket, it also spends a lot of time talking about the experience of writing this book and the experience of travelling around to write this book. And what that leaves possibly is not enough time to really delve into some of these clubs and to talk about the background and some of the concerns that that go into running a cricket club in the 21st century, and how you keep that alive. I think
this idea of the sort of too much, and I think this is a challenge that many cricket books face, actually, is you are trying to do many things simultaneously. I mean, you mentioned that one thing Fuller does is describe some of the people involved, some of the volunteers, and I think for me some of the most memorable sections of the book are these pen portraits. So the passion, for example, of the groundsman at Glasshouses Club, who kind of gets up every morning and is completely staggered when someone asks him, if you didn't do all this, then who would? And it's kind of moments like that that I think are very powerful. I think the argument of trying to do too much also possibly relates to this broader question, which I guess the book's trying to answer, of like the health of the game. And Fuller is clearly someone who knows his cricket, but I'm not sure we ever quite get a full answer on a real theory on the health of the game and its future. I feel like we get lots of portraits without maybe building a kind of overall argument on that.
Absolutely. I mean, look, cricket literature, as we have often explored on this podcast, is a varied, wonderful, and deep thing. And I think when you publish a book to sit alongside others in that canon, it's always a slightly challenging thing. I think what's interesting about this book is it is interesting to read it alongside other pieces of literature about the county game, and you mentioned a couple of those at the top, A Last English Summer being one that really stands in the mind as one that is really able to very evocatively call up what county cricket is and what county cricket means to the people who work within it. And I think in the context of those works, this is actually, you know, this is valuable in adding some colour at the grassroots. It wouldn't necessarily be the kind of book that I would recommend to someone to start their journey into cricket literature. But I think it's definitely it's got some valuable, you know, statistics, insights, and it's certainly been written with a lot of love.
And no one, I think, could read it without a desire to go and play or visit some of these grounds. I mean, I think some of these descriptions are stunning. I think actually one thing I wondered at one time is how much I'd have craved some photography here, actually.
Oh, totally.
Because you think,
yeah,
these
exactly.
are some wonderful venues. And I mean, it is, of course, one of the, one of cricket's many joys that, some of these small clubs can have venues that stand alongside kind of any sporting venue of the world for sort of sheer beauty. And of course, the Yorkshire scene very, very much helps with that. And I think also some of the range of the sort of range of the club game, as you say, it takes into account so many different venues, and you range from all sorts of types of club, you know, clubs that sort of cater for very, very different types of players, which I guess in itself is a certain argument for the health of the game.
So that is All Wickets Great and Small in Search of Yorkshire's Grassroots Cricket by John Fuller. And that was the 109th episode of Reverse Swept Radio. Thank you for joining us as ever. And happy cricketing until we all talk again.